From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. According to the old adage, the only things certain in life are death and taxes. Oh, medical technology, like the IRS, can sometimes grant an extension, but sooner or later, even the best medicines fail, and the end of life arrives. How will we handle it? How prepare? Well, too often we're not prepared. Not really. And neither are our doctors.
Physicians in training see, on average, 28 deaths a year, which is about a death every 2 weeks. But the problem, I think, for all of us is that we believe that helping means curing, and we don't realize that death, as much as life, will be a part of our lives.
Every step you take is, in a way, one step closer to death. Like, we all take 850 million breaths, and, you know, that's an amazing statistic to me, that, you know, the average person takes 850 million breaths in his or her lifetime, and each breath is an amazing experience, and each breath is that much closer to death.
The facts of death in this hour. Thoughts on how to approach the end of life from people who've been there.
She wanted to live at any price. She was somebody who simply didn't, for whom extinction, death, whatever you want to call it, was unbearable. And so she was going to fight for every breath.
That's David Reif talking about his mother, Susan Sontag. She was one of America's most celebrated intellectuals, a woman known for her fierce intelligence and uncompromising critical stance. A woman who, as it turned out, could not handle one of the most basic facts of life, that it ends. A few years ago, Susan Sontag developed a lethal form of blood cancer. She tried everything, including a bone marrow transplant. And right up to the end, she refused to let anyone tell her she was dying. Now, her son, David Reif, has written an account of his mother's last days. Swimming in a Sea of Death is the story of how he tried to do the right thing for her, while also being true to himself. Reif told Steve Paulson that Sontag fought her illness to the very end.
Half the subject of my book is that, is what is it when somebody, no matter how terrible the odds, thinks that extinction is so unbearable that you must fight, and what does that mean when we are all going to have to die?
It is worth pointing out that twice before, your mother had cancer and survived. And one time was, I mean, the odds were incredibly stacked against her.
They were. She had survived a cancer about which her own doctors, this was in the mid-70s, a time when American physicians tended to lie to their patients and tell family members something closer to the truth. And I was told by her doctors that she would die quite soon. She had a stage 4 breast cancer that had spread into the lymph system. So you're right. She had a basis for thinking that when a doctor said it was hopeless, it wasn't necessarily so.
And yet it seemed to be clear, at least the way you write about this, that it pretty much was hopeless in this case. At least that's what you were being told by the doctors, but I had the impression that that's not what your mother wanted to hear.
Well, a cancer for which there's no treatment, where you're talking about either total cure or death, is a much harder cancer than, say, cancers that can be treated by radiation or chemotherapy, where maybe you're not going to live 10 years, but say you might live 3. You might get some remission. This is a roll of the dice. And my mother was 71, and this bone marrow transplant is harder and harder to do successfully the older you get. So, you know, the chances were indeed very stacked against her. But she didn't want to hear it. I mean, again, that's sort of the subject of this book, which is as much as anything a book of questions. It's what do you, as the person who's close to someone who wants to live at any price, do when you think maybe this fight isn't worth it, or where you, I mean, do you lie? Do you insist on telling the truth when it's perfectly clear that the person doesn't want to know the truth, which was certainly true of my mother.
Even though on the surface she did say, don't lie to me, but every indication was she didn't want to hear the truth, and she wanted it both ways.
Well, she did. She just wanted to be lied to. I mean, she didn't want to be lied to. It's almost a stupid way of me to express it. She wanted to live. And she hoped, I think, that I and other people in her life would give her reason to hope. But when the bone marrow transplant really started to go wrong, which was pretty soon after it took place, I didn't think she was going to make it. And yet every signal she was giving me was, you know, give me hope, help me believe I might make it. And in the end, I chose to do that. I thought, well, the first and most important thing I thought was it's her death, not mine.
Was that hard for you, though? I mean, you weren't telling her the truth. I mean, did that take a toll on you?
Yeah, I think it probably did. Well, it exacted a tremendous price on a certain level in that I never got to say goodbye. I mean, whether people really have these things or not, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the end of life. I mean, but we never had the kinds of conversations where I suppose if I'd had my druthers, I would have liked to have had with her conversations about the past. I would have liked to have said certain things to her, including just things, you know, we had a complicated relationship. There were very good times and very bad times between us. I would have liked to have gone beyond those, at least before she left us. But that's impossible if you decide not to acknowledge the fact of dying. So sure, I mean, that's the price I paid.
The way you write about this, it wasn't just that she desperately wanted to live. She was also terrified of dying. I mean, there was a kind of existential dread there.
There was, yeah. I think lots of people are really terrified of dying. I've also met lots of people who aren't, but she was one of the ones to whom it was just terrible news. I mean, one of the things I quote in the book is a famous poem of the British poet Philip Larkin, which is called Obad, which is a poem of terror about no longer existing. And I know there are other people for whom dying is okay. And of course, I think some people of faith at least find it easier.
Yeah, let me follow up on that because your mother was an atheist. She refused to accept any consolation in the hope that there might be an afterlife. I'm wondering how much of that played into this dread.
Well, I'm an atheist too, so if anything, more militant than my mother. So I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that question. I will say that I think it would have been grotesque of my mother to have become a person of faith purely in the interests of consoling herself. I mean, surely that would have been the most terrible therapeutic use of faith and a sort of disgrace in terms of faith. I mean, if you don't believe, you shouldn't suddenly start believing because it suits you. I mean, you believe for other reasons.
But it does raise the question, without the consolation of religion, does the prospect of dying necessarily lead to dread? How much of that contributed, do you think, towards your mother's panic?
Well, it sure doesn't help. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. There are certainly religious traditions that don't believe in an afterlife. So I don't think one could just take the Christian or the Islamic model and say, well, you know, those visions, which are visions of a personal afterlife, are what religious faith is. I mean, if you look at Buddhism, if you look at Judaism, both of those have no afterlife in that sense. So I'm not sure it's faith versus atheism is all I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the last days?
Everything that could go wrong did go wrong after the transplant. So she's really suffered in a way like somebody being tortured. I mean, she, by the end, couldn't even roll over unassisted. Anyway, once she died, I asked the other people to leave the room, and I spent some minutes, and I really looked. I took her shirt off, to be blunt. And she was just a sore. The body was just a sore from the inside of her mouth to her toes. So the suffering was extraordinary. But the actual death was comparatively easy in the sense that she wasn't in pain, as far as we could tell. And then she sort of, in the last days, kind of withdrew. And when she spoke about the distant past, about her parents, about people she was involved with 30 years before. She really wasn't focused on the present or any of us. And then she lapsed into a kind of somnolence and she died.
Now, these days, there's a lot of talk about what's often called a good death. And usually this means someone who accepts dying and stops fighting it. There's a certain kind of resignation. And then often, the way people talk about this, there's a certain grace that can follow. Not only is there a sense of inner peace, but the dying person often has very meaningful and profound conversations with friends and family who are close. And to use a word that you scorn in your book, there is some closure. I guess by contrast, it would seem that your mother had anything but a good death. Do you see it that way?
No, I think that's something people say to console themselves. I don't believe a word of what you just said. I don't mean you're necessarily, I don't know whether you believe it or not, but I mean, I know this argument very well. I think that argument does a real disservice to human variety. I mean, people are very different. They're very different in their lives and they're very different in their deaths. And the idea that there's one good death, as it were, one good death fits all, seems to me a kind of incredible reductiveness of what human beings are all about. I mean, it's like saying all human beings should be cheerful. Well, I don't think I don't know that being a cheerful person is better than being a melancholy person. People have different temperaments. I think when you say grace, I think it lets the family members off the hook. They don't have to feel so bad that the person is going. That seems to be more germane to that kind of stereotypical good death that people talk about today than anything else. So I'm afraid I don't buy it.
It also sounds like you're saying that this is the way your mother had to die. Given who she was, there was no other way.
Well, what I'm saying is that because people are so very different, the right way for one person to die may not be the right way for another person to die, or the necessary way. And she was somebody who desperately didn't want to die. So why should she have made our lives easier by going gracefully?
David Reif talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir, Swimming in a Sea of Death. You can read a print version of this interview on Salon Magazine. Visit our website for links and more information. It's at ttbook.org. Now a different take on dying, from a friend and former colleague. Judith Strasser was diagnosed with stomach cancer in January of 2005, about 5 years after she retired as a producer and interviewer for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Last summer, a tumor in her lungs attacked the nerve which controls the larynx and paralyzed her vocal folds, making it difficult but not impossible for her to speak.
I've known for a long time that nothing and no one lives forever. When I was 24, my mother died. She was only 48. A few years later, I was hiking in the Sierra Nevada through a forest of giant Douglas firs, tiny seedling firs, huge, dead, and rotting fir logs. I had my eye out for deer. The sun lifted the scent of humus into the air, and I suddenly realized that death, the death of trees and deer and people too, is simply a part of life. When I was 37, I confronted my own mortality. I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, a potentially fatal cancer. A year of intense chemotherapy and radiation saved my life and probably also caused the stomach cancer that spread to my lungs 18 months ago. Unlike Hodgkin's disease, metastatic stomach cancer has no cure. I'm only 63. Many Americans live into their 70s and 80s. dying before the age of 65 seems obscene. But when my cancer spread, I was given a prognosis of 9 to 18 months. I've outlived that prognosis, but I'll be lucky to make it to 64. Still, I'm not afraid of death. As far as I can tell, when you're dead, you're dead. It's the people who are left behind who suffer, not the dead person. The process of dying is more problematic. Of course, I'd like to avoid pain. And I really don't want friends and family to endure a death watch that lasts endless days or weeks. But I've done what I can to ward off such miseries. I have a certain amount of faith in my doctors, hospice, my relatively high tolerance for pain, and the power of morphine to make the process of dying as easy as possible. And I was relieved to learn when a good friend died recently that a cancer death can be relatively quick. Many people don't want to think about death, their own especially. But for me, it's essential. Facing death is the only way I can live. It makes me grateful for every day I have, because I know I may die soon. I try to be conscious of how I live, how I spend my time. Time is precious. It's really all we have. Time and the knowledge that after we die, life and the world go on. No one is indispensable. We each make our small contribution to the cycle of life. After we're gone, we live in the memories and the actions of our friends and families. Our bodies return to Earth. But like those dead and decaying fir trees in the California mountains, our essence remains, a whiff of immortality.
Judith Strasser is a former producer and interviewer for To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can read more about her approach to life and death on her blog, In Lieu of Speech. You'll find a link to it on our website at ttbook.org, where you can also read the script of Judy's commentary. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Death is a subject some of us try never to think about, while others can't seem to stop thinking about it. Writer David Shields is one of the latter, his dad, the former. When Shields set out to write a book about death, a meditation on how exactly our bodies decay and die, his 97-year-old father told him it was a waste of time. That tension between father and son animates the pages of Shields' new book. It's called The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead. He told Anne Strangechamps that as far back as he can remember, he's been a death-obsessed kind of guy.
There's a short passage in the book of Woody Allen-ish moment where I'm 9 years old, you know, and I'm sitting on the top of the stairs leading to my basement bedroom surrounded by spiders and, you know, sort of creepy crawly things. But I just couldn't believe the fact that one day I would no longer exist. I had this unbelievably vivid image of myself being covered in dirt in a grave, and it just seemed impossible that little Davy Shields, you know, would one day no longer exist.
Did you tell your father about that or your parents at all? And what was their reaction?
I don't think I told them, to be honest. I think that death, like sex, you know, is something of a taboo topic. I quote in the book the novelist Cormac McCarthy saying, "Death is the major issue in the world for you, for me, for all of us. It just is. To not be able to talk about it is very odd." And I just love that line. And in a way, this book is an attempt to address the oddness of it. And it's not just death per se. We're all aware, of course, we're a mortal species. We're going to die within, you know, 50, 100 years at the very longest. But because what it does, it's like winning the lottery or perhaps losing the lottery that, okay, you're going to die. Therefore, how to live? It's not the fact of death. We're all aware that we're going to die. It's how much are you wasting your life?
Well, or do we not talk about death and avoid talking about it with people we care about? Because it seems really rude. Like, you know, to get through life, we all have to kind of construct this fiction that we're not going to die, because otherwise we might just sit around and mope a lot. And so it seems very rude to expose the fiction.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right, that it does seem rude that so much of our investments in life's tasks, whether it's building a family, you know, building a business, creating a work of art, it's really a castle that's made out of sand. And when you point out that ultimately, you know, the waves are going to come and wash it away, it's hard to keep on task. And so much of the book for me is to strip away the illusion that we all walk through life with. I mean, I feel like I want to strip away the illusion and still love life.
And yet there's this odd counterpoint that runs through your book that adds considerably to the complexity and the pleasure of it, which is the character of your father. It's a portrait of a man who lives life absolutely completely and fully and with great pleasure, has an enormous appetite for life, and he never thinks about death.
Right.
So that's this sort of gives the lie to what you've been saying, doesn't it?
That's a good point. I think you're right. I mean, I think, in fact, in reality, he actually does think about death a lot, but he's buried it so many fathoms deep that one can no longer see it. But yeah, I think that my dad is obviously a crucial, complicating figure in the book. And, you know, I'm 51, and I'm this sort of middle-aged baby boomer who's trying to eat right and watch my diet and exercise, and I'm sort of death-obsessed. And here comes my dad, the sort of raw, physical, somewhat unconscious, primitive being who does sort of dig life, and he seems to have all the answers without even knowing what the questions are. I mean, part of the book is about temperament, that he's not drawn to this stuff. And I just visited him yesterday at his condominium in San Francisco, and he was talking to this 97-year-old German woman who was sitting on the bench right next to him. She turned to him and she said, "Well, I'm just sort of twiddling my thumbs. I'm ready to die." And my dad looked at her as if she had just farted, you know. I mean, it was like he just said, you know, he basically just stared ahead, and it was as if he just could not believe that she said that. And he just would not. He was like, how dare you as a 97-year-old woman be prepared to die? I mean, and my dad is exactly 97 himself. And it was just, I mean, it sounds like I'm making this up, but this is what she actually said. And he had this very grim look on his face, like, no, I'm living to 142, and I'm not going to go to this place in which you are talking about being ready to die. I mean, how? And it was just an unbelievably powerful moment.
Well, your dad seems like somebody who just, in some ways, just really doesn't have time for death. I mean, you tell a story about, didn't he once have a heart attack during a tennis game, and he kept on playing?
They were playing doubles, and he had a so-called mild heart attack during the tennis match. And rather than, God forbid, cry uncle, he said that, you know, he and his partner had always come close to defeating these other guys. And here they were on the verge of finally defeating them. And my dad wasn't going to let a heart attack prevent him and George from finally defeating these other guys. I guess one thing I would say is, you know, there's a huge amount of self-mythologizing in my dad. I mean, and my dad did have this heart attack. I mean, it's definitely a matter of medical record, but I think a lot of his life instinct is to tell himself and us and me and the reader, you know, sort of fairy tales of superhuman power. And in so doing, build himself this self-perpetuating mythology that definitely helps him get through the day.
Mm. You did a ton of research for this book on the process of our physical decay, like what happens to our bones, our muscles, our senses as we age. It sort of sounds like from what you've discovered, we're kind of in the process of decaying from our 20s on.
It's unbelievable. I mean, that's definitely stayed with me. You know, there's this line in the book, our birth is nothing but our death begun, which is just, that could easily have been the title for the book. I mean, there's a lot of data to that effect throughout the book. I can quote some of it to you to make sure that your listeners are all completely suicidal at the end of our talk. But the best example of it for me is, like, for instance, your brain size peaks at age 25. I mean, that's kind of depressing. Or to me, what's terribly interesting is that your pineal gland knows how old you are. And as soon as it realizes that you're past your reproductive prime around 45, your pineal gland starts to produce far lower levels of melatonin, which signals all your other systems to break down and the aging process to begin. I mean, it's such a parable of spawn and die.
Didn't this depress you to write? I mean, didn't you wind up feeling like you're just a walking carcass?
I find myself strangely giddy after writing the book. I find myself far happier than I was before starting the book. I really love life. I don't know how long this feeling will last. Maybe when the book tour is over, I'll go, you know,
you'll
crumbling
crash
into a fetal ball. But right now, I feel it in this sort of almost corny new age way. I just really, I love the intersection of life and death that's inside my body. And I just understand, I don't have any illusion that life has greater transcendental meaning than just, you know, we are these animals walking the earth. That were, there's a line in the book, I say something like, you know, that we're a bare body housed in a mortal cage. And I just really get that. And I really love life in the way that one can when one strips away life's illusions and sees life for what it is in its sort of gorgeous emptiness.
It sort of sounds as though you found something very beautiful in our animal existence. I mean, in the fact that we are simply these bodies, these sets of biological processes. sort of as though, I mean, it's interesting for a writer. I always think of writers as people who are, you know, kind of trying to ensure themselves some immortality by leaving their words, making a mark. But it sounds as though for you, you discovered just having a body and being an animal is enough.
To a large degree. I know it's, I certainly wrestle with that idea. I mean, I think for a writer, you know, obviously the major illusion of your continuing existence is you hope that people read your work after you're gone. And obviously that would be part of the writerly dream. But as Woody Allen says, there's a wonderful line in the book. He says something like that, I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment, you know, and just, you know, and that, you know, I feel like what I love about life is consciousness. I mean, what distinguishes us from being dead is that we are alive and thinking. And I just feel that very powerfully, you know, that we're all, you know, we all have this gift of life. We all have this burden of mortality. And unlike lower species on the totem pole, you know, we are aware of our mortality. I mean, my cat, Zoomer, who makes a cameo appearance in the book, you know, just loves existence but isn't aware that he will one day die. Whereas, you know, the specific burden of human existence is that we are consciously mortal. And therefore, we do things like build cathedrals, start wars, create art, rage against the machine of our bodies. And, you know, it's the fact of human existence that we are consciously mortal beings.
David Shields, talking with Anne Strainchamps about his book, The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When Pauline Chen began medical school, she dreamed of saving lives. Like every young doctor in training, she soon discovered that a doctor's life is also full of death. But dealing with death, knowing when to let a patient die and how to comfort their families, wasn't part of the medical school curriculum. Today, Pauline Chen is a transplant surgeon and a gifted writer. In her book, Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality, she writes that it is surprising how unprepared doctors are to deal with death, considering how much of it they see.
Physicians in training see, on average, 28 deaths a year, which is about a death every 2 weeks, which is quite a bit. You know, when you multiply that by the number of years for residency, anywhere from 3 years to, for me, it was 9 years of training, death becomes pretty common. But you know, for physicians, it's interesting because, you know, we want to help people. But the problem, I think, for all of us is that we believe from the beginning that helping means curing. And we don't realize that in our professional lives, death, as much as life, will be a part of our lives.
I should probably tell you that a couple of 3 years ago when my mother died. And I tell you this because it colors the way I think about this. It colors the kind of questions that I would ask, I suppose. She was in the ICU. She was on a ventilator. She was in a coma. I spent a week with one doctor who essentially prepared me for the fact that she was unlikely to come out of that coma and that she would die. And I helped my father, who has dementia, to come see her. And then they shifted. They switched doctors, which of course you have to do because you can't, as a physician, be there all the time. And the first doctor who had been so helpful left, and the second doctor wanted to start all over again. and wanted to help, wanted to find ways that might conceivably bring her back. What it did for me and for my sister eventually was to make it more difficult. And it struck me then that in spite of their familiarity with this, they didn't know how to help a family go through this.
Right. We don't get much training with it, with end-of-life care. And predicting death right now has become more and more difficult as our medical technology has sort of exploded, blossomed in the last decade. And because many of us don't have end-of-life care training or experience, especially the older doctors among us, older meaning people of my generation, I finished medical school in 1991, I think that you get situations like this where there are different messages relayed to families.
Well, it's interesting to look at the training because you talk quite explicitly about the training that you got, the good as well as training that you wish you'd had. It's startling for an outsider to realize how early a medical student is introduced to death, the fact of death. You write about the first cadaver that you had to deal with. And it's hard for me to imagine what that must be like.
It was hard for me to imagine, too, actually. I walked into the laboratory rooms, and on these tables, they were metal tables that slid out, they looked like coroner's tables, were white body bags. And you knew what was in them just by the shape of them. Some were bigger, some were smaller. And I remember unzipping the body bag that was mine and my lab partner's. And the medical school put the bodies face down as a way to sort of protect the students emotionally from the experience, you know, sort of gently ease us in.
So the first thing you see wouldn't be the face.
Right. But the first thing I saw were the hands. And I don't think I'll ever forget her hands. I had a female cadaver, and she had beautifully manicured nails, and each nail was painted with coral-colored fingernail polish, and above each cuticle was a little rim of bare nail, as if it was time for another manicure. And on her left ring finger, there was a line, you know, tan line, so you could see where her wedding band had been. You saw where her watch was. And I remember thinking when I saw those hands, this is a person who is not that different from me, who just, you know, however long ago was walking on the street, I could have passed by her, who had a whole life. And as we dissected the rest of her body, we discovered that life. You know, I discovered that she died of ovarian cancer, which was, you know, at that time we had been in her body for, I think, about 2 months. And I grieved for her. I suddenly knew what her last days were like, what her last months were like. It was really moving to me. I've never forgotten this woman.
It's an extraordinary story, but it leads me to wonder then what happened next, because as you describe it, this is a moment when death was very real to you. The connection between life and death was very real. And it is though somehow medical training forced that connection apart for the next several years.
One of the things that we had learned was when patients die in the ICU, and I suspect you might have seen this in your own experience, that we believed that we should leave the family alone with the patients in the last moments because, and we convinced ourselves of this, that the patients' families wanted their privacy. So every time a patient of mine died, I left the room and I tried to make myself scarce until the patient had actually died, the family had come out, and I went about my job officially declaring the patient dead and telling the family what to do next. But one patient changed that, and this patient was a middle-aged businessman who had colon cancer that had spread to his lungs and his liver. And he was on the regular surgical floors at first, and I remember rounding on him a couple of times a day, and his wife always stopping me and pulling me outside of the room and saying, "Dr. Chen, when can we bring my husband home?" Because she knew, and he knew, that he didn't have long. And I would say to them, well, we're working on it. We're trying to.
There's a little bit more we can do.
Exactly. There's a little bit more that we can do. And unfortunately, he only got worse. We transferred this gentleman to the ICU, and I was on call one night, and it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and I realized that he probably didn't have much time. So I called the attending surgeon, and I called the patient's wife, and they both came in, and the wife was in tears, obviously. And so I started to do what I always did, which was I would bring the attending surgeon and the patient's family, his wife, to the patient's room, and then I'd turn around and leave. So I turned around and left, and I fully expected the attending surgeon to come out with me and to leave this wife in there alone. But he didn't. And I stood outside of the room. I stood outside there for a few minutes wondering, okay, he's going to come out and I'll just wait. But he never came out. And so I finally looked into the room, and what I saw there, I'll never forget it. It changed my view of my work. I saw him pointing to the monitors and explaining to the patient's wife that this was how the final heart rhythms of life looked like. I saw him pointing to the patient's chest and explaining that at the end of life, a person's breathing changes and not to be alarmed. And I saw him touching the patient's arm and saying to the wife that her presence there in that room, even though her husband appeared not to be aware of it, gave her husband great comfort. And I can still see it, and I'll never forget it, because that moment I realized that as a doctor, as a surgeon, I could do more than just cure.
It's a lovely story.
But it isn't. There's a real lesson for a lot of us in there.
I wonder if there isn't a lesson of humanity in here somewhere, too, because so many of us refuse to face the prospect of our own deaths. I wonder if doctors in general might benefit from facing that. I think you did. You talk about your 83rd liver transplant.
Yes.
Does it help? I mean, maybe you should explain what that's about.
In my transplantation fellowship, after I'd finished my general surgery training, one of my jobs was to procure organs from patients who had been declared brain dead and whose families had decided to donate their organs. And I had done many of them. And after a while, the operation, like all operations, become somewhat routine. But you face death over and over and over again in these rooms. And in some ways, I became hardened to it, and I never thought of my own mortality until the 83rd procurement. And this patient, who was brain dead, was an Asian woman, Asian American woman, who was about my age. And I remember as I went to operate on her, we had to drape the operative sterile drapes over her body, sort of being struck by the fact that here was a woman that was about my age who looked somewhat similar to me. But then I sort of pushed that out of my mind and went to my job and laid the drapes down and covered her body completely except for a line that went from the base of her neck down to her pubic bone. So there was a little strip of flesh. And I started the operation with the other surgeon. And I started working on the chest, and he started working on the abdomen. And as I cut into her chest, the drape fell. And what I saw was her breast and the way her chest was formed. I saw the undulations of the ribs, the fall of her breast. And what I saw that night, and it was the middle of the night, it was just as if I had stepped out of the shower and looked at a mirror and saw myself. And it stopped me. It took me a while to sort of regain my composure, and I tried to continue the operation, and the drape fell again. And I struggled with this through the operation, and I remember leaving that operation at the end after we had taken her organs to give to someone else. I remember leaving that night feeling this profound exhaustion, for one, but grief. And I couldn't really figure it out. Why did I feel so sad? Until I started writing about it and thinking about it and realizing that what I had witnessed, in fact, was what I had come face to face with was my own mortality, my own sense that, you know, this could have been me.
Pauline Chen is a transplant surgeon and a writer. Her book is called Final Exam, A Surgeon's Reflections on Mortality. For much of this hour, we've been circling around the question of what makes a good death. Is there really such a thing? I don't know, but I do know that at the end of life, things can become both very simple and very profound. And at times like that, sometimes something very small, a piece of music, for instance, can make all the difference in the world. This is the story of one such moment. Ed Wohl's memory of his father's death.
My dad was in the hospital in late 1999. He had had colon cancer and it metastasized to his brain. And my whole family was there, my sister and mother and aunts and uncles. And at 5 or 6 or 7 or whatever time, everybody got ready to leave. And I said, you know, I just think I'll just stay overnight. I said, I feel better, you know. I didn't want to leave my dad alone. It ended up being about 10 days that I stayed every night overnight. My dad was pretty much unconscious at the beginning and then totally unconscious, but a couple of things that happened. At the hospital, I got to know the night staff, which in a hospital at night is incredibly different from a hospital in the daytime. They had more time to chat, more time to talk, more time to explain what was going on. I would always have music playing, and I would tell people about my dad and what he'd done and what he was, you know, what his life was like. And so I just brought in a variety of music, and one of the pieces I brought in was Missouri Sky. I'd never heard it before that. I'd heard of Charlie Hayden, and I'd heard of Pat Metheny, but I'd never heard that music. And it just happens to be one of those albums you can play a lot and you never get to the point that said, you know, you say, I don't want to hear it again. So that's how I came across that album. My dad got progressively worse. And it was obvious he wasn't going to recover. He had a staph infection, and they took him off. He just was on pain medication, so it was really the end of his life. So I sat with him at night. I'd read to him or read to myself and listen to music. And every morning at 5:36 or 6:30, a group of doctors had come in, and the oncologist on call was a woman about maybe a little younger than me and her, you know, a group of interns and residents. And, you know, she and I would converse a little bit, and I would tell her a little bit about my dad. And, I recognized the situation that it was kind of awkward for the interns and residents. Here's this guy dying, and they didn't really make eye contact with me very much or say anything to me. They just kind of observed, and she would comment to them and leave. And the last morning, my dad died about 9 in the morning, and they came in at 6 o'clock, and I was sitting next to him on the bed holding his hand, and that album was on. And this woman, this Dr. Silverman, put her hand on my shoulder and just said, well, I'm sure it won't be long now. And I was kind of teary-eyed, and I said, well, you know, I'm in no hurry, you know. I've got a father, and then I won't. So there was some comment like that. And then the last piece came on, and the title of it's Spiritual. It's a long piece, and it maybe was started as we were talking, but they just didn't leave. Everybody just stood and listened to that piece of music. Afterwards, I kind of, this woman was standing still behind me with her sort of arm on my shoulder or whatever, and then I turned around to sort of you know, kind of say something to the group, and almost everybody had tears in their eyes. And one of the interns or residents, a young woman, said, "Oh, so that was the most incredible piece of music I've ever heard." Just before I got on the elevator downstairs, I had called my wife Anne, and I thought it was by Josh Haydn, and it is. It's by his son. It's called Spiritual, but I never knew there were words to it. And Anne, my wife Anne, read me the words, and the words are, "I don't want to die alone," but it's addressed to Jesus, and our family's Jewish, and of course, that would not. It was an interesting. It was so interesting, that juxtaposition. So. But it was, "I do not want to die alone." That sort of a phrase. And it was, "Jesus, don't let me die alone." But I was, you know, it was an interesting, it was a wonderful experience. And one of the nurses had said to me earlier that I was trying to say how I wasn't exactly happy to be there, but I was happy to be there every night so my dad wouldn't be alone. And she said, "Well, I think the word you're looking for is a privilege. It's a privilege to be with somebody you love when they're dying." And of course, that would be the case.
Edward Wohl's father, Max, died in 1999. Ed himself is a nationally known woodworker. You'll find his work in galleries and museums around the country. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Thanks for listening to this hour. If you have questions or stories of your own you'd like to share, you can email us through our website at ttbook.org. We always enjoy hearing from you. Copies of this program can be ordered from the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Good Death Hour.
PRI, Public Radio International.